The final faculty member interviewed for this program was Dr. Randy Hecht, and to begin, he commented on systemic treatment of colorectal cancer, and specifically the issue of predictors of lack of response to EGFR antibodies.
First, you have to remember that really the only genetic marker that's really validated, has been validated so far up until very recently, has been KRAS. And we talked about MSI, but I'm talking about from actually prediction with the drugs that we have. People have looked at TS, people have looked at ERCC1. We have no markers for bevacizumab, but you know, that was showed Rafi Amato and others had shown that patients who had KRAS, and what they meant by KRAS is they meant by exon 2, codons 12 and 13, that's what they looked at, that about 40% of patients had those, and there's no benefit with an anti-EGFR antibody. So 60% of people are so-called KRAS wild type, but only looking at that group. So there have been a number of groups that have looked at it, and people have used different names. I've actually been part of some of this research. We call it expanded RAS analysis. Other groups have called it all RAS. I don't think all RAS is exactly right because it isn't exactly everything, but it's sort of like the old story about the drunk and was asked, why is he looking for his keys under the street lamp? It's because that's where he can see. So we only see the mutations that we look for. With the genomics revolution, it's become much cheaper to look for other mutations. So they're outside of exon 2. There are small number of other mutations in various hotspots. If you add NRAS together, you add about another 10%. So about 40% have the canonical, classical exon 2, codon 12 or 13 mutations, and you pick up about another 10%. Interesting, HRAS mutations are virtually never found. BRAF has been looked at. This has been argued a lot. If you remember your biology, it's downstream from KRAS. A certain percentage, it varies from up to 10 to 15% early stage to 5% in salvage, have a V600E mutation. It's a very, very bad prognostic sign in metastatic disease. Initially, it was thought that it was predictive for anti-EGFR antibodies, but that has not been borne out. So there have been a couple analyses of well-annotated trials, like PRIME, which was a first-line panitumumab trial. This was actually published by Jean-Yves Dillard in the New England Journal recently. I think that's one of the papers that you're referring to. And what they looked at is that this was a first-line trial, FOLFOX plus or minus panitumumab. So no bevacizumab in this, just chemotherapy plus or minus. And when you looked at the patients who had the non-classical RAS mutations, that they also didn't get any benefit. And in fact, not only did they not get any benefit, they actually may have done worse. And that's been shown before with the classical KRAS, sort of like what you're asking about the fluoropyrimidines and MSI. The hazard ratios aren't one. They're always over one in these groups, both for cetuximab as well as for panitumumab, which is really interesting from a biological standpoint. I can't say that it's all toxicity. There's a lot of really interesting work in feedback loops, for example, so downstream, so that we know that like BRAF inhibitors don't work in BRAF mutant colon cancer. And one of the reasons is because you go downstream, you actually may upregulate EGFR. So we may be tweaking the biology in a bad way by giving these patients. So the take-home messages from this are, one, KRAS is dead. And in fact, there's going to be this kind of mass retesting of patients who are KRAS wild type with metastatic colon cancer who have not gotten anti-EGFR antibodies yet. Because we thought they were wild type, but there's a chance that they may actually have other mutations, so they shouldn't get an anti-EGFR antibody. The problem is this still has not made it into the label yet. There are labs, commercial labs are available in order to check. UCLA is actually a reference lab, and so we have, as part of a panel, we're working with companies. But for clinicians, my suggestion is that it's 2014, you need to ask this. The other interesting part of this is that as you peel away patients from anti-EGFR antibody therapy, in other words, patients who shouldn't get it, then actually what happens is that the people who are truly wild type may, you know, sort of statistically have more of a benefit. And where this may be more important is when there are now a number of trials looking head to head. I don't know if this is where you were going with this, but in metastatic disease, there are three head to head trials. So looking at chemotherapy plus an anti-EGFR antibody versus, and this is in wild type, chemotherapy plus bevacizumab. In the United States, bevacizumab has the lion's share of biological therapy in first line, actually in second line as well. In Europe, not so much. So the question has been, which biologic should we use? Clearly, bevacizumab wins on toxicity. I mean, nobody likes the anti-EGFR rash. I've run on a lot of the panitumumab trials. I'm very aware of the rash. People don't want it. But there's some interesting data that if you hone in this group of patients that may be most likely to benefit from anti-EGFR antibody therapy, maybe there actually is a difference. So the first trial was the PEAK trial, and it was presented by Lee Schwartzberg. I'm actually on the paper for disclosure for that, and I ran the second-line head-to-head trial. But in that study, there was a randomized phase 2 with all the caveats of a randomized phase 2, FOLFOX Bev versus FOLFOX plus panitumumab. There appeared to be an improvement in progression-free and overall survival in that group of patients. First of all, actually in KRAS wild type, but that got even bigger when you kind of made the playing field smaller. Okay. But that's a randomized phase 2. So then the other large trial that's been presented in the last year is FIRE-3. And FIRE-3 was chemotherapy plus cetuximab versus chemotherapy plus bevacizumab. This was a German trial, and it was actually the primary endpoint was actually response rate. Now, why they chose that, I think, was, to be honest, to make cetuximab look better, because there was the thought that these drugs actually have a higher response rate. Interestingly, not. There was a high response rate in both arms, and it was the same. But what was interesting was that the curves for overall – there was no difference in progression-free survival either. But the curves actually, they diverged after most of the patients would have been off the therapy. And there was a difference in overall survival. And this was really unexpected. And now this has been redone with this expanded RAS analysis, and it holds up and may even look a little bit better. But there's been a lot of head-scratching as to why this might be. People have postulated, well, maybe you changed the biology of the tumor if you're on bevacizumab in a different way than if you're on this was a cetuximab trial. The Germans, in their German way, instead of depth, they say deepness of response, meaning that maybe the responses, even though the numbers were the same, were somehow better on cetuximab, and they're trying to go back and look at that. I think that's less likely, but possible. But I think that the decider for this that everyone is waiting for is the 80405 trial, that Alan Vanook is the principal investigator. That was chemotherapy, actually dealer's choice, though most patients got oxaliplatin-based therapy, plus cetuximab or bevacizumab. We hope that it'll be out at ASCO, though I'm not certain. And I think that may answer that. Okay. And the answer?
It's been submitted to ASCO. So until we see those data, how do you go about deciding between Bev and an EGFR antibody in KRAS wild-type metastatic disease?
First of all, the side effects for an anti-EGFR antibody will always be more. As I tell my patients with bevacizumab, the side effects of bevacizumab are silent, but if they happen, they're potentially catastrophic, but rare. And so the 10% of people who don't feel they have hypertension, arterial thrombotic events are increased a little bit, as well as perforation rate, about 1.5% in the randomized trials. But, you know, I have to say we tend to see the perforations, maybe I'm just on a streak right now, in patients who've had like been multiply radiated. These are not the straightforward person, the one that is going to be seen in clinical practice. And I've always told the people who make anti-EGFR antibodies, you can't tie, you've got to win because of the toxicity issue. And now the other thing, I don't know if Alan talked about, is I know that they're doing the expanded RAS analysis as well.
Right, absolutely.
And so I don't know if this – I think the original data – so when this trial is old enough that it actually started out as all comers. And in fact, there was even a combination arm, people don't remember, which was dropped because actually my trial, PACE, and then there was also another trial, CAIRO-2, that showed that combining them with chemotherapy was not a good idea. And then the trial was also changed to make it only KRAS wild type, meaning codons 12 and 13. But I know that they have blocks on them. You know, they've done a good job of tissue collection. And so I'm curious whether this is sort of a just a KRAS. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And whether that's a great point. That's a great point. It would surprise me if they've got this extended RAS analysis done by now.
They should, because they've been waiting for OS. The NCI made them do OS as the primary endpoint, which I have to say is good, but it made it a huge trial, and it means that it took a long time.
But my point is, in terms of the markers, I would guess that the new markers they probably don't have right now.
Oh, maybe. They've had some time to work on it, but you're right. I agree with you. I think
maybe
they probably
they do.
Don't.
Maybe they
I think
do.
Heinz Lenz is supposed to be the guy who's going to be working on it. A number of groups are kind of working on this.
Well, it would be really interesting if they did all the new markers and they still were kind of the same, the two arms.
Well, I think then the answer to that one will be that things will stay the same.
So bottom line, just, yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to ask you. In your own practice in general, what tends to be your first line therapy?
We still, I have to be honest, we still use bevacizumab in the vast, vast majority of patients frontline because of the toxicity issue. And that FIRE 3 is interesting, but we haven't really changed our practice necessarily for that. Now, one other thing that was kind of interesting that some people had changed their practice with was the new EPOCH trial, which was presented a little while ago. And one of the things that goes to that response rate, you know, the idea that maybe an anti-EGFR antibody gives you more of a response rate. And when would you need a response rate? Well, if you're trying to make someone who's marginally resectable, resectable. Now, resectability is a squishy endpoint. So what they did is added actually cetuximab to chemotherapy and showed, one, it did not improve resectability, and two, the patients actually did worse. So if we need to get someone to resection, we actually use all three drugs together, 5-FU irinotecan and oxaliplatin, like Falcone.
I was going to ask you about that. Just to clarify, though, in the usual first-line situation, you use FOLFOX with Bev?
I tend to use CAPOX.
CAPOX, okay.
And so, but I think that, you know, when you go back to the 16966 trial, they were the same. The only sort of thing that I would say is that that was a mostly European trial, and they tended to use higher doses of capecitabine than we use, so I can't say that's exactly. Part of that is my practice pattern, because being in Los Angeles, people come from far away, and even if they don't come from far away, the traffic's not so good. So coming once every 3 weeks makes people really happy, as opposed to coming twice every 2 weeks.
Right. Yeah, I'm surprised that CAPOX isn't used more, because we find much more FOLFOX used. So you mentioned the other situation people talk a lot about in terms of first-line therapies, quote, when you need a response. You mentioned using oxali as well as irinotecan and 5-FU, and we saw a paper at the last ASCO meeting on the so-called FOLFOXIRI regimen with Bev. What exactly do you use when you need a response?
I think you have to peel that into two different ways. So one, you know, we're actually a big metastasectomy center, and that's one of the things that as an oncologist also makes you, sort of like adjuvant, makes you happy, because you really want to cure people with metastatic disease. And even though the surgeon, they just hold the knife, we like to think that we're the ones that cure the patient. But we work very closely with our surgeons. We work very closely. We have a whole hepatobiliary team that works on these. And your question actually has a couple sub-questions. One is, should patients get chemotherapy before or after or both with surgery? Now, the Nordlund-Jay trial, which is the one big randomized trial other than the new EPIC, gave 5-FU and oxaliplatin before and after surgery and showed actually only a modest benefit in survival. It was a small trial, but they had to tweak it to make it statistically significant. There is no right answer. So some people with small tumors, particularly if it's been a couple of years since the primary and it's easy to get, they go right to surgery, and then we give them presumably adjuvant afterwards, particularly if they haven't gotten recent adjuvant therapy. Other people, you want to use the biological filter, because the surgery is the hardest part. You don't want to send someone to surgery and then on the next scan have 20 tumors or extrahepatic disease. So those patients we tend to treat up front, but we do worry about CASH, chemotherapy-associated steatohepatitis. So for the clinicians who are out there who may be thinking about referring a patient in for surgery, I think it's really important to be talking to the surgeons early on. I have seen people who've been treated for a year and a half and have a big spleen and have a huge fatty liver who have operable disease that becomes much more difficult and high risk, and to see whether or not we can do that. So that's one question. The other question I think you're bringing up, Neil, is sort of the marginal patient, the patient who doesn't have extrahepatic disease, but maybe that it's difficult to do for technical reasons. It's up against a vessel. The tumor's too big. There are other tricks you can do, like portal vein embolization and hypertrophy of the other lobe. But for those patients, the FOLFOXIRI has been very interesting with very high response rates, this combination. You know, the Italian group has been doing this. We've been playing with these very expensive drugs like bevacizumab and cetuximab and panitumumab. They just added everything together and ended up with really high response rates and a very high surgical resection rate. And so particularly young, healthy patients who need that downstaging in order for the surgeon to say, gosh, I'll give it a try. Those patients, actually, we use FOLFOXIRI. And now the other question is about the role of bevacizumab, and I'm going to bring those things together. So there's some theoretical reasons why bevacizumab may be problematic preoperatively. One is that it does cause wound healing problems. And this is a big wound. This is not a laparoscopic, even though people are talking about laparoscopic liver resection, that these patients come out with a peace sign or a Mercedes-Benz sign on them. This is a really big surgery. And you want it to be done in a place that has lots of experience with the surgeon, both the surgeons as well as postoperative care. But if that wound falls apart, that's a big problem. And so we had a long discussion about, does it make sense to give bevacizumab up front, and how safe is it? And the current sort of wisdom is, and in fact, I published an editorial about this in JCO a number of years ago, is probably waiting at least 6 to 8 weeks after the bevacizumab. Remember, bevacizumab has a 3-week half-life, and patients seem to do pretty well. And it doesn't seem to inhibit liver regeneration. The liver is amazing. You can take 2/3 of someone's healthy liver out, and if their liver is healthy, it will regenerate. It's amazing how much you can take out. Now, what's interesting is that unlike FOLFOXIRI, remember adding bevacizumab to FOLFOX doesn't increase response rate. So then you could say, well, what exactly are you doing? In the adjuvant setting, bevacizumab doesn't help because if you're worried about treating micrometastatic disease elsewhere. So I don't know if there's really clearly a role. A lot of people do it. And then what they did is they added, not just for resection, but they added bevacizumab. This was TRIBE. And they added bevacizumab to FOLFOXIRI and had an extremely high response rate. And people did extremely well compared. I think it was FOLFIRI-BEV was their control arm. They like that to be their control arm. And I think it's very interesting. I would love to have those markers you were talking about to say, because if someone has a good response to FOLFOXIRI, did they respond to the 5-FU? Did they respond to the oxaliplatin? Or did they respond to the irinotecan? Did they need all of them? I don't know. But it's really intriguing data.
So a couple more points on colon cancer. The first is second-line therapy, metastatic colorectal cancer, and particularly the issue of continuation of bevacizumab versus aflibercept. Where do we stand on that today?
So this actually goes back to a couple things. One, the original second-line trial was Bruce Giantonio, ECOG 3200, in patients who had not gotten Bev, and it was FOLFOX versus FOLFOX-Bev. Patients usually don't get this. It's a group of patients that don't exist anymore, actually versus Bev alone, and there was a significant improvement in overall survival. Genentech was able to get a very broad indication for first or second-line. And you know, the question is, what does or mean? And people interpreted it, and a lot of people were giving it both first-line and second line, even though the second line patients did not match what was in the ECOG 3200 trial. So then the next sort of information was the BRIGHT registry. And that was Axel Grothy actually published that. And this was looking at bevacizumab beyond progression. So these patients, they looked at anyone who got bevacizumab sort of after they had already progressed on bevacizumab. And these patients did incredibly well on this. And this, I think, shows the pitfalls of a registry. And in fact, as a clinical trialist, it made it hard to do trials in second line that didn't have Bev with other biologics because people were pointing to, well, you see how wonderfully these patients do. There are a lot of problems with registries. One is people who live longer tend to do better, and people who live longer tend to be treated again, particularly since it was pretty loose to be able to give bevacizumab. So then finally a trial was done, and that was the TML trial. That was a German AIO trial that was eventually taken over by Roche. And these patients, that's treatment in multiple lines, TML. And once again, continuing bevacizumab, switching to what you didn't get first line, showed a modest benefit in this kind of range of what we usually see, this hazard ratio 0.8, not home run, but kind of bunt or single, but that you could see. Now, at the same time, aflibercept was being developed. And aflibercept had actually a very slow development as VEGF trap. And in fact, is an artificial antibody. A lot of people don't have experience with aflibercept. And with the binding regions of the receptor fused to an Fc domain, so it does hit VEGF-A, which, remember, bevacizumab is a monoclonal antibody specific against VEGF-A, but it also hits placental growth factor. And a little bit broader, and another ligand in the VEGF family that also interacts with VEGF receptors. And so that trial that was done, which was the VELUR trial, and that included people who had gotten bevacizumab frontline and people who didn't. And overall, once again, a very similar kind of hazard ratio in the 0.8 range. And then when they did an analysis about those who got Bev frontline and those that didn't, it looked very similar. So I think with that data, which you can say that it is reasonable to continue bevacizumab second line. I think it is reasonable to give aflibercept second line in patients who've had bevacizumab front line. Both of those are very reasonable things to do. I wish that they worked better. I think there may be some differences in toxicity, but that's only in cross-trial comparison. There were some questions about increased GI toxicity in Valor. There were a lot of differences between the trials where Valor, as a registrational trial, was much more rigid. For example, in the doses of chemotherapy that had to be given, TML was looser. And we know that as clinical oncologists that we don't always follow a protocol in our practices and how we start someone dosing and how we also do dose modification. So both of those are very reasonable. The question is, where do anti-EGFR antibodies fit in second line? The only actually data that we have is a trial that I ran, which is a randomized phase two called SPIRIT. And that was FOLFIRI panitumumab versus FOLFIRI bevacizumab. And within the caveats of a randomized phase two, they looked very similar. Differences in toxicity.
Have you used aflibercept at this point?
Still have not used aflibercept. I think that what I see in the community are there are people who are really comfortable with bevacizumab, and the patients are comfortable, so they continue. That being said, also there's a smaller group of people who say, hey, it didn't work, let's try something else. So I think actually in some ways there may be more uptake in the community than in academia.
One other thing on colorectal cancer. Update on regorafenib, another recently approved agent. I'm curious what your recent experience has been with that agent.
So regorafenib, for those who may not be familiar with it, is a small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor that is actually very similar. In fact, there's only one atom difference to sorafenib, but there are some differences in spectrum of activity that blocks VEGF receptor 2. It also blocks a number of other related tyrosine kinases, which, depending on your point of view, may be good, or it may, you know, if that causes efficacy, or it may be bad if that causes toxicity, then it's a dirty kinase. And this actually goes back, Neil, to what you were saying about bevacizumab beyond progression. So one of the questions that comes up is, you know, one of the reasons people thought about it, because normally we throw drugs away when they don't work. Cytotoxic agents, hey, you know, the oxaliplatin didn't, we don't tend to recycle these things. And I'm a GI oncologist. I don't know, you probably know better about other malignancies, but we tend not to recycle these unless we have a great reason to do so. So the idea was is that you were somehow affecting the host with these anti-angiogenic agents, and you know, you're kind of changing the cytotoxic. And the other thing that I've always wondered about is that, remember we talked a little bit about feedback loops, is that they're clearly feedback loops. So when you block one part of a pro-angiogenic pathway, there's upregulation of other pro-angiogenic factors as well. And so the other thing is that the body, in effect, is trying to make VEGF-A. So then you basically take away your antibody that maybe you actually get a rebound. I mean, that's been hard to show. There is a little bit of preclinical data, but it's a bit of a stretch where they've given anti-angiogenic agents and looked at metastasis. So theoretically, you may change either the host or you may change the tumor by putting these people on bevacizumab so that you may need what I sometimes have called bevacizumab addiction, where the patient actually does better. And there are other things. We're going to talk about GIST. Obviously, people do better, you know, even if they've progressed on an anti-KIT drug. So I have to give credit, because what they did was to look not in combination with chemotherapy. Small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors have not been successful in combination with chemotherapy. In fact, I ran one of the first trials. It was a very large trial with a drug called vitalinib. They've looked at sunitinib. I actually ran a sunitinib trial. There have been lots of other ones. They just don't work very well. And part of it may be excess toxicity. So what they did is they said, okay, we've got a drug. We'll just look at it single agent, and it was versus best supportive care. And in that trial, it was regorafenib, 160 milligrams. Axel Grothy was a principal investigator versus best supportive care. And what you can see is that, not surprisingly, the response rate, tumor shrinkage, was pretty close to zero. But there was a modest improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. The hazard ratio was actually pretty high. But remember, people didn't do so well because this is salvage colon. So that is, as you said, is FDA approved, and that is right now the standard of care. The problem is this is not the easiest drug in the world to give. And regorafenib was approved both in gastrointestinal stromal tumors as well as for metastatic colon cancer. And the main toxicities are sort of like what your physicians may be used to with sorafenib, bad hand-foot syndrome, fatigue, which may be due to PDGF inhibition, some GI, it's really hard to give the 160 milligrams. And you get people, I think good people, in a room. And Neil, you, I remember you asking people, what dose do they start with? And it was interesting because I've been in two of them where you asked twice. One was a group of perhaps a little bit more senior people, maybe we're more afraid, where virtually no one started it at 160. The question was, do we start at 80 or do we start at 120? While there was another group, I think it was skewing a little bit younger, that they were following the label. My personal experience has been a couple things. One, it's really hard to give 160 milligrams. Two is this is a modestly active drug. And I finally got my first person to their second scan. And I think that's just part of the disease. And so I'm not saying it's not worth giving or not worth using. The one thing I will say is that I don't have any ethical issues with doing a study drug versus regorafenib. And because I think the benefit is modest. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be used. We often start, as I said, at 80 personally, and then if a patient really tolerates it well, we'll kind of escalate up. The problem is by the time we've escalated up, often they've come off treatment.
Yeah, actually, we're finding very few investigators who start at 160. 120 is very common. Some people 80. But you're right. Actually, the same survey I was just telling you about of the general medical oncologists in practice, the most common dose they use is 160.
Wow. Because I think that they just don't – there are a couple things. One, they may not have as much experience. Two, you know, they may not know the literature as well or may not feel comfortable enough to go against the label. I've also heard from, you know, as a referral center, we talk to obviously lots of people in practice. So we're not just kind of in the ivory tower. But I think some people, after one or two bad experiences, may not even be using it at all because they've been burned with bad experiences with it.
So I want to finish out talking about GIST, and maybe we just finished up talking about regorafenib and colon cancer. We can start out at that end in terms of metastatic disease and what's happened in the last few years that's affected the way you take care of these patients. And I would assume
you're talking about GIST patients, right?
Yeah, GIST.
We're transitioning. Okay,
right.
So, you know, as a GI oncologist, we love taking care of GIST patients because they tend to do well. Unfortunately, probably the center of gravity has shifted to the sarcoma doctors from an academic standpoint. There are a few of us who, like Chuck Blanke and myself, who are kind of holdouts. But I like to consider GIST to be because it comes from the GI tract. I mean, come on. And it's often rewarding. That's a better way of saying it. It's rewarding to take care of. So we were part of a lot of the original imatinib trials. And in fact, we put over 40 patients on the original SWOG trial that Chuck Blanke, who I just mentioned, was the principal investigator. And I remember the days when we had nothing to give these patients. They were still – and watching people get out of their sick beds and go and play golf and things like that. I mean, there's really, truly amazing. The other things that we've learned is also how important it is if you treat GIST that you also have as a partner radiologists who you trust. And so I think this is a really important clinical point that we learned early on that the responses that you see in GIST are often not RECIST responses. There's so-called CHOI criteria. These tumors become necrotic. And this is for the practicing clinician. I think it's really important to talk to your radiologist and make certain that they're reading it correctly for a couple of ways. One is that actually the size of the tumor can get slightly larger, but it's dead. And in fact, these become PET negative, the ones that respond, and most do early on. The second thing has to do with recurrence, is that the bidimensional measurements may be the same, but if you're looking at the scan, that the soft tissue component can be increasing, and this is actually progression. And even though, as I said, the bidimensional measurements may be exactly the same, that's a separate issue as whether we should do anything locally destructive to those. So imatinib really became that well-tolerated patients on average did relatively well. That's clearly not curative. I have one patient out of that 40 left still alive. I think it's like 11 years later. So obviously we didn't cure patients with that. So then the next question came up, what do we do with these patients who progress? And the next drug that was approved was sunitinib. And sunitinib was approved, but the way it was approved is versus best supportive – you know, the original trial was versus best supportive care. And the response rate is much lower than first line. But they clearly do better on sunitinib than they do on best supportive care. And some of them actually have shrinkage of their tumor. I think one of the things that was shown by this – and in fact, there was just recently – it was an Asian trial – I think it's called the Wright trial, if I remember correctly. You know, people have to come up with a clever name, where they showed that even if you progress on imatinib, it is better to be on imatinib than on nothing. So back to what you had said before, Neil. I mean, even though we all thought that from looking at, for example, the sunitinib trial, that still, even if some of the clones that are there, and we know from GIST that if you go in and you actually biopsy, there may be 10 or 15 different molecularly different clones in there, it's still better, maybe like prostate cancer. It's still better to have androgen inhibition even if someone is resistant to androgen suppression. So it's better to still be cranking on c-kit even if the patient is progressing. So you had sunitinib, which was better than nothing, and that was approved. And then regorafenib recently was approved in patients who had failed first and second line therapies. The question that comes up and people will ask me, well, what about sunitinib or regorafenib in first line? And the problem is that in general, imatinib is really well tolerated. While I have to be honest, sunitinib is generally not as well tolerated. And regorafenib, we just talked about some of the problems that we have. I spent an hour speaking to a physician with metastatic just yesterday in my office who's actually having problems with imatinib. And we keep bringing up, well, do you want to go on to something else? And they're afraid of the toxicities. Unfortunately, they read the labels. But I can't say that the others are wrong. There's just no data for that. And I think that even though I've had patients who say, oh, I enjoyed sunitinib or I tolerated sunitinib more than I did the imatinib, that's the minority position. And I think we go by toxicity.
What about efficacy? What's been seen in terms of regorafenib? I guess it was the GRID trial that looked at that.
Well, it was interesting because if anything, I think it looked a little bit better than the sunitinib data. And once again, it's really hard to do cross – I'm sorry?
It was impressive.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to do cross-study comparisons. People have also wondered whether or not the GIST patients may tolerate regorafenib better. And that's kind of anecdotal as to one way or the other. And maybe they are. Maybe they've never received cytotoxic chemotherapy. You know, perhaps they're in better shape. So I think that it's interesting. The problem is that because patients can do so well for such a long period of time, these people all have incurable disease to start out with. And, you know, if you're on imatinib and you're doing well and the tumor's not growing, it's hard for me to make that better. And so the percentage of people who fall off rapidly from imatinib in first line is actually relatively small. So moving, I think, regorafenib first line, I think it's more likely perhaps to be moved to second line rather than to first line.
So final thing I want to ask you about in terms of GIST is adjuvant therapy. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of provide an overview of that and what we've learned recently?
I think you bring up some interesting points. And so we just finished talking about colon cancer and adjuvant. And one of the things that you see with colon cancer is that after surgery, there's a fall off and then the curve plateaus. And so we know that almost all patients with colon cancer who are going to recur are going to recur in the first 5 years. When we treat people, for example, as we were talking about with fluoropyrimidines, what we do is we change that curve. And so the people fall off, but the plateau is in a different place. Okay, these are the long-term survivors. So, and that's the delta, that's the difference. Now, we think that cytotoxic agents may actually kill micrometastatic disease. And there is a difference, perhaps. We don't know. I mean, all drugs have targets, but between a biological agent like imatinib, which may or may not kill as many cells, though when you look at the CT scan, you know, that's dead on the inside, those tumors, as opposed to a cytotoxic agent. So the first trial that was done was the ACOSOG trials. And that was first a single-arm trial. That was imatinib in the adjuvant setting. And then there was a randomized trial of 1 year versus nothing. And there was an improvement in relapse-free survival initially. But if you look, the curves kind of come together the farther out that you go. So I think you delay recurrence as much as you may prevent. The thing that always worries me is that that plateau at the shape of the curve, it all kind of tends to come together. But it was approved and became, for higher risk tumors, became the standard of care. Then there was the Scandinavian sarcoma group study that was 3 years versus 1 year. And this was interesting in a couple ways. One, there was actually a survival difference, though the thing that I have to say is that the number of deaths in both arms were really small. And second of all, if you look at the relapse curves in this, very few people relapse when you're on imatinib, and then it falls off. And eventually, if you take these curves long enough, they get very close together. Now, more recently, there's been a trial of 2 years versus nothing that did not seem to show the same benefit and has not gotten the publicity or the awareness. And I need to kind of crank into this more. You know, there are people who are particularly advocacy groups who have been very big in pushing adjuvant therapy. And I work with the advocacy groups. But I have to say, unlike colon cancer, I think that the adjuvant data is weaker. And if someone told me that they did not really want to or they don't want to stay on, 3 years is a big commitment. This is a huge commitment. And even though imatinib has relatively little toxicity compared to some of the things we do to patients, it's not without toxicity. There's edema, there's fatigue. Patients will tell you once they come off, they said, oh, I didn't realize how much better I felt until I came off. So I think that the new trial actually, you know, once again, when patients say they want to come off and after a year and a half or something like that, and they say, I just can't take the imatinib anymore, then I think that gives you some cover.